Hello, and welcome to the Links Incorporated LinkedIn Learning Connected in Conversations podcast. I am Kimberly Jeffries-Leonard, National President of the Links Incorporated. In this episode, we are discussing an issue that should literally be near and dear to the hearts of all African-American women, heart disease, which kills nearly 50,000 African-American women annually. As members of the Links Incorporated, we are committed to the heart health of women, especially African-American women, as well as all people of color. Through our HeartLink Signature Program, we equip our members with numerous ways to implement heart-healthy programs and activities in their respective communities. We have been lucky to partner with the American Heart Association on so many of these critical initiatives. To help with this crucial conversation, at the heart of the matter, Black women and cardiovascular disease, I am honored to have with us three of our incredible Links members today. Kelly Epps Anderson, MD, Medical Director, Women's Cardiovascular Health Center, Inova Heart and Vascular Institute, and President-elect of the American Heart Association Greater Washington Region. She is a member of the Potomac, Virginia chapter. We also have Jennifer Donnellan, who is Director of Communications at the District of Columbia Fire and Emergency Medical Service, and she's a heart attack survivor. She is also a member of our HeartLinks committee, and she is a member of the Potomac, Virginia chapter also. And last but certainly not least, we have Mary Clark, a senior public health specialist and the Links Incorporated first and to date the only National HeartLinks and Walk for Healthy Living chair. And she serves as our national community partner liaison. She is a member of the Reston, Virginia chapter. Welcome, ladies, to this podcast.
Thank you.
Let's start with Dr. Epps Anderson. The statistics surrounding heart disease in African-American women are astonishing, but I am not sure if people understand their impact. Dr. Epps Anderson, can you talk about how heart disease is affecting women of color?
Yes, thank you very much, Madam President. So heart disease is the number one cause of death in all women in the United States, but African-American women in particular have an even higher risk of dying from heart disease and dying at a younger age than white women. One half of Black women in the United States have some form of cardiovascular disease. What's even more concerning about this is that many of us don't even know that this is a risk. Only 36% of African American women know that heart disease is their greatest health risk. And only one in five African American women, when you ask them, do they feel that they could personally suffer from heart disease? Only one in five African-American women believe that they're personally at risk. In addition, maternal mortality is a big issue with African-American women. We know that maternal mortality is often driven by cardiovascular disease, and it is at its highest rates amongst Black women. Black women are three times more likely to die from pregnancy-related causes.
Wow. Okay. So you have given us a lot to think about as it relates to Black women and heart disease and all of the things that it impacts across the board. So let me talk with Jennifer Donnellan just a little bit. You had a heart attack and at the relatively young age of 36. Can you talk about the events on that day? Where were you? What were your symptoms? What stands out to you in general about that day when you had a heart attack?
Thank you, Madam President. I was 36 years old. At the time, I was a television news reporter. I had had an exceptionally high stress day. It was a high stress career, but that particular day was definitely what I would recall as being off the charts in terms of stress. I was out in the field. I was at 42nd and Benning Road, Northeast in Washington, D.C. I had just finished a television live shot. We were waiting for some comments from the mayor's office, so we decided to stick put where we were. We were there about 45 minutes. It was the end again of a very stressful day and we had just sort of relaxed. We'd gotten the product finished and gotten on air. When I was on the phone with management asking if we could clear the scene, I started feeling a pain deep inside my chest. I have always described it as something feeling like it was miles away inside my core that I had never felt before. At the time, it was slight and then it started growing. I got off the phone, I turned around to my two coworkers and said, I don't feel well. I took a few steps, my left arm went numb. Now, I'm a 36-year-old woman of color. I am not a older white male. When my left arm went numb, I was not thinking, oh, I'm having a heart attack. But at the same time, my left arm went numb. So I started wondering if it could be, but still was not accepting of what it might be. I then turned to them, asked them to call 911, told the other to call my mother, and I was down on the ground. I'd become nauseous. And I also had what is a classic effect that many heart attack patients describe, which was this terrible sense of doom. Something was horribly wrong, and I didn't know what was wrong. And I knew that that ambulance had to get there as quickly as possible. I was very fortunate at the time that the particular paramedic who tended to me didn't look past the fact that I was 36 years old, which can happen a lot in the medical community. They see a young woman having chest pains and they write it off as panic attack. He treated me as a cardiac patient, despite the fact that my EKG was normal inside the ambulance. He gave me nitroglycerin. He gave me baby aspirin. He began to do some things that were critical to my survival. He called ahead to the hospital, had a cardiac care team waiting for me as we arrived. They raced me in, and I'll never forget the two doctors, the woman who was perhaps my same age, telling me things are going to be happening very carefully, very quickly now. You're having a heart attack. And that's when your life completely changes on a dime. They raced me back to the cath lab. They discovered that I had had what's called a spontaneous coronary artery dissection, or SCAD, which is a potentially lethal situation. What basically happened in layman's terms is the inner lining of my right coronary artery tore like a piece of fabric. It flapped down. It stopped blood from flowing. The blood that was trapped began clotting. The interventional cardiologist had to go in, clear out the blood clots, and then he inserted two stents and reopened flow in that artery. And the pain, as awful as it was, just suddenly disappeared. It's as if it never happened. And it was the best feeling in my life. Some of what Dr. Epps was just talking about, this is a particular, it's not your classic, you know, I had clogged arteries. My arteries looked great. But what I had was I suffered from an episode that they've discovered 80% of the victims are female. Why? A third of these victims all have suffer SCADs after they have babies, or picking up heavy items, or having stressful days. We don't know why women suffer from SCADs. They need a lot of studies to be done, but because classically they've done these studies on men and not on women, we don't have answers. But this new crop of female cardiologists are out there trying to get answers, and they're doing the research now. And that gives me a lot of hope for the future.
You know, to hear you even describe that day, I can't imagine how you could have felt. I mean, it's terrifying to even listen to you talk about that. And the fact that, as you said, you were 36, and thankfully they treated you as though you were having a cardiac event is probably the reason why you're here today. So Dr. Kelly Epps Anderson, you talked about the fact that most of us don't even know that we're at risk. Most of us take, you know, some of the symptoms for granted. But here we hear Jennifer talking about her experience as a 36-year-old woman having a heart attack. What are some of the risk factors that we should be looking for? And what can we, other than this, you know, you talked about some, but what are some of those risk factors that we really should be mindful of? And what can we do to protect ourselves against this particular issue?
Thank you, Jennifer, so much for sharing your story, because I think it really is impactful to hear someone tell their story and to know that it could happen to them too. I think a lot of women assume that it can't happen to them. And like you said, particularly given how young you were. And knowing risk is so important. We know that younger women tend to know less about their risk factors. They report that they're less likely to have ever had a conversation with their physicians about risk. And so I think that it's important to know that this is something that women need to think about across their lifespan. It's not just something that older women need to think about, although we know the prevalence of cardiovascular disease is higher in postmenopausal women. It's so important for young women to begin thinking about it as well. So when we think about risk factors, we think about risk factors that are non-modifiable, and we think about modifiable risk factors. The non-modifiable risk factors are those risk factors that we can't change, but they're important for us to know about and important for our physicians to know about because they do impact our risk. That's things like our age, our race, our family history, so important to talk about because it can impact our future risk. And then we think about the modifiable risk factors that we can change. That's risk factors like high blood pressure, high cholesterol, diabetes, smoking, obesity, and physical inactivity. And it's important as African-American women in particular to know about these risk factors because unfortunately we have a higher burden of many of these risk factors. 46% of African-American women have high blood pressure. And there has been research that has shown that there is probably a genetic link between high blood pressure in African-American or Black Americans because we are more likely to retain salt. And salt tends to raise blood pressure. We know that African-American women are 3 times more likely to have diabetes compared to white women. 80% of Black women are overweight or obese, and 41% of Black women are physically inactive. So it's important to know also that there's a multiplier effect when we see a clustering of risk factors in any individual. So having 3 risk factors doesn't just triple your risk, it increases your risk tenfold. So it's so important to have a healthy lifestyle to help manage these risk factors. And the good news is 80% of heart disease is preventable by managing these risk factors.
Wow. So here we see the risk factors that we need to be mindful of. And some of them are absolutely things that we can address. You talked about some of the genetic areas that we can't really do anything about. But there's certainly things that you brought to the forefront that, you know, just by simple tweaks in our lives, we can take those factors down exponentially. So Mary Clark, you've held so many roles in the Links Incorporated. In fact, I remember when you were our Health Linkage Chair and you've done so many things. And as you have been the only Heart Links and Walk for Healthy Living Chair. We find ourselves here today on February 28th at the end of Heart Month. We've had some very critical information given to us by our cardiologist. We've heard from a heart attack survivor. And while Heart Awareness Month comes to a close, what do you think we should be doing beyond February to ensure that we are keeping this issue in the forefront?
So I think we're already doing it, Madam President. Our focus on physical activity gives us an opportunity to do this all year long. And what I mean by that is you challenged us to walk at least 5,000 steps a day. And you told us that we had to collectively walk 75 million steps. And so we did that. We exceeded that. We walked over a billion steps in a year. So then you said, well, okay, now I want you to walk 75 billion steps. And we're working on that now. And I think that to answer your question, because of your leadership, we have been able to do things that are simple, fun, and easy in terms of our membership. Well, I go back to walking, and I think about what Dr. F said about walking. It's something that moving, I'll say not just walking, but just moving, because some people can't walk. But moving is so important because when you think about our risk factors of obesity, diabetes, heart disease, high blood pressure, we know the science tells us that moving can really move the needle to lower your blood pressure, help you to lose a little weight. And so I just think I can't say enough about how you understand behavior. And we are trying to change behavior. I want to make that point for about 27 years. The Links have focused on lifestyle and behavior change. And so we want to lead by example. And so we put just as much emphasis on our members as we do other members of the community. And we have institutionalized walking. And this is one program that has been sustainable. We've been doing this for 27 years. and our members look forward to it. And every year, we move the needle with this program. And if I may say one more piece about that, we have included this year, we're walking to and working out to music. And people are loving it. They're having fun. When they don't feel like walking, they're so involved with the music that they just keep walking. So, and again, this is another tool. And I know you didn't ask me about tools, but I'm just going to say that this is a tool that has helped us. And going back to what you did ask me about doing all year long. I mean, that's what we do. The magic of all of this is we're doing it all year long. We start in February, we start in September, and then we're moving into February, and then we move forward to the National Walkathon, and so we're this, the Lynx Incorporated is an example of how you can change behavior. Because that's what it's all about.
You said a couple of things that I think that we want to make sure that people kind of hear. We're talking about changing behavior. We're talking about changing mindset. And it really kind of comes full circle because Dr. Epps did say that actually it was a very startling percentage of those of us who really aren't moving at all. And when you think about these little small changes, what a difference they can make. Jennifer, I like we said, the fact that you're here sharing your story, the fact that you had this life-altering experience at such a young age, how did that change your lifestyle? You were really forced to change your lifestyle, but what kind of changes did you make?
So, Madam President, I was in a hospital bed when I found out that heart disease was the number one killer of women. That's how I found out. I did not know. I was worried about breast cancer. Because that's what I thought was going to strike me down. So, I had a platform on which I could do something. And I went through being a news reporter at the time. And I went through what I now look back on and can see were the stages of grief. I had to grieve my youth, grieve my sense of immortality. And I just got slapped in the face with, you came this close to death. So at the time, I had to tell my story, and in part of telling that story, I had to get honest about one thing that I was embarrassed about and ashamed, and that was I was a smoker, and I was a closet smoker, and I know many successful women who are closet smokers but don't want to talk about it because we're too smart and we're too successful that we can't be doing something or seen doing something that's stupid, and society places it's not embraced. And so I had to come out and say, I smoked cigarettes. That was a huge thing for me to say in front of thousands and thousands of people, but it needed to be said. And the feedback I got from some women was just amazing. They were like, I was afraid to talk about it and it is hard. And so I quit smoking cigarettes. It's now been 11 years since that heart attack. And I want to make sure our listeners understand the struggle is real. I had this life-altering experience, and it is a struggle for me to get up and go exercise, to eat the right foods, to not eat fried foods and opt for the salad. It is a minute-by-minute, hour-by-hour, day-by-day struggle. And trust me, I don't preach that I'm a saint. I have moments where, I've got to remind myself, hey, you've already been there, done this. And I have to work at it. I'm not somebody who can eat whatever I want. And the scale reflects what I put in my mouth. So, I know it's a real struggle for a lot of us. We get busy, we have busy lives. And a lot of times the person that is the least of our priorities is ourselves. And so it's a constant conversation I have to have with myself. But I'll tell you, programs like this help remind myself, and I hope take a moment for our listeners and remind them of the importance of taking that time out and making themselves their number one priority.
That's an important comment, making yourselves the number one priority. I think that when we talk about making ourselves the number one priority, then we're talking about addressing a lot of these issues that go into the health disparities, the health outcomes that we see right now. You know, Mary, you have been doing this for a while. And when we talk about taking time out for ourselves and making ourselves a priority, what are some of those heart healthy programming, other than the movement that we've been talking about, that we've incorporated that can help our members be our best selves?
Thank you. I think about our HeartLinks toolkit, and I think about the resources and the tools that we have. And the tools that we use for the community are the tools that we can use for ourselves. And so, for example, our HeartLinks curriculum, heart health curriculum, I think about the information that's in the toolkit that talks about the relationship between diabetes, obesity, and heart disease. That's all about us. That's what Dr. Epps just said. I mean, so everything that we have in that toolkit, there are recipes that are there, you know, for heart healthy cooking. And I want to take a minute to thank you, because you, Madam President, created that toolkit. And it's a one-stop shop. You go there, I go there, and I learn things and I get information that can help me. And again, like I said, we always have to remember, it's not them and us, it's us. So whatever's there for the community is there for the members.
You know, the toolkit is important. And I know that the thing about that toolkit, which is for our members and also for our community, it's really a dynamic toolkit in the fact that it's a living toolkit. And so it's updated as the science changes, it's updated as things change. One of the things that has changed that has dramatically impacted how we take care of ourselves is the COVID-19 pandemic. Does the toolkit address that COVID-19 pandemic and how we can do things a little bit differently while navigating it?
Yes, absolutely. There's a lot of information about how you can implement virtual programs. And during this pandemic, that has been, I mean, that even though this is a bad thing that happened, there are some good things about the environment that we're in. Number one, we can reach more people. We can reach each other. I'm in Virginia. A person may be in Hawaii, and we can do our programs together. In fact, we can collaborate. We can attend these programs. And so that, as I look at it, that's been one of the tools that has been most effective, because we've shown chapter members how you can reach people in a virtual environment. It doesn't always have to be physical. And like I said, we're reaching more people, and we're reaching more of our members, because they can look at what others are doing, so then they can replicate what they're seeing. So I think that's probably, in my mind, that's been one of the greatest assets and benefits in terms of the environment. And lastly, I'll say that what members are saying to me is that, you know what, when we can go back, that's fine, but we need to have a hybrid model. So we'll have some face to face, and then we'll do some virtual.
You know, the pandemic has absolutely allowed us to be able to be broader in our reach with programming, to help our members look at how we do program in a different way. But what the pandemic also has done is kind of really ripped that blanket off, that veil off of, you know, what disparities really look like in our communities. We knew they were there. We knew they were there all along, but it wasn't until we had to stop and sit and look and realize the impact of COVID-19 on us and our communities that we started really being able to see and feel the impact of the health disparities across the board in our communities. So Dr. Epps, have you seen the impact of COVID on women and heart disease? How is that that manifested itself? What changes have you seen when we talk about overlaying COVID-19 on heart disease in Black women?
Right. So, you know, we often hear that women with COVID-19 fare better than men with COVID-19, which is true overall. But when we don't look at race, we are hiding what's really happening with Black women. When you look at the intersection of race and sex, what we actually see is that Black women still die at a disproportionately high rate, that Black women are 3 times more likely to die from COVID-19 than white men. And some of that is driven by heart disease. We know that heart disease does play a role in determining the severity of illness. That's why it's so important to know your risk factors, to make sure that those risk factors are well controlled so that you're optimized in case you do, unfortunately, come down with COVID-19. So important for you to continue to see your doctors. I think one of the things that sort of was a tragedy as a part of the pandemic is that patients were afraid to come to healthcare facilities. And patients are still hesitant, even though we may be in a better place with a pandemic. Patients are still hesitant to come in, and they're hesitant to get their testing that we may order. And what we've seen is there's a significant impact on delaying treatment, patients staying home, and as a result, becoming much sicker when they finally do present to us, when they have their heart attack or their stroke. They're in a much worse place. And that's in part why the American Heart Association did start a campaign during this pandemic, recognizing what was happening, recognizing the disparity. And the campaign is Don't Die in Doubt. So really showing the community that hospitals still are the safest place to be if you're having a heart attack, if you're having symptoms of a stroke, even during the pandemic, that it's still so important to be connected to the healthcare system and to make sure that you're seeking care. And I think part of what was revealed with the COVID-19 pandemic was racial disparities in disease and risk factor burden, which is, I think, partly why we're at higher risk for severe illness, but also access to care and quality care.
That's important. Don't die in doubt. That says a lot, because we don't want to let those behaviors that are going to keep our health optimized, as you said, we don't want to let those go. And I think that there have been a lot of strategies put in place to allow people to feel more comfortable, to make sure that they're getting those critical screenings and going to the doctor when they don't feel well, where otherwise, like you said, we've been afraid to do that and the outcomes have not been so good. So, you know, this has been a really fascinating conversation. Let me go to Jennifer. Given everything you've been through and given where you are now, what advice would you give your younger self and others around heart disease?
Know thyself, love thyself. And know thyself, know your numbers, know your history, think about your heart. You know, now that I'm woke, so to say, on cardiac issues and all matters, I tell young women that you need a cardiologist like you have a gynecologist. You know, I think the cardiologists look at your body differently. And now that I've seen my body through the eyes of a cardiologist, it was a game changer for me. I didn't know the history on both family side about heart disease. And it also, love thyself, love yourself in the truest sense of the meaning. You know, find things you love doing. I used to love dancing when I was a young girl. When I was a little girl, I was a ballet dancer. As I grew up, I used to love dancing. I stopped doing it. Why? That was exercise without, you know, there was no argument there. Who knew? You were keeping yourself healthy and you were enjoying it and you felt free. It was a stress reliever. So do the things you love. Stop and smell the roses. Stress, you know, get the stress out of your life. It's all going to be there no matter what. And enjoy life, because it's not even a morbid thing to say. It's a very real thing to say. We're not promised tomorrow. So why speed this along? And why not stop and enjoy your family and friends and take care of yourselves and really love yourself? Those would be my pieces of advice. And based on something that you just said and Dr. Epps said, one of the things that we did see during the pandemic were people not calling 911. And I now work for, as you mentioned, DC Fire and EMS. One of the things that we're truly stressing is that people learn hands-only CPR. because the out of hospital cardiac arrests are a very real thing. You may well likely be around someone that suffers cardiac arrest. This is a simple tool that we can all learn so that we can help our loved ones. God forbid something like that happens in our homes or in our places of business or when we're out on the street, but we can save lives. And so if we're talking Heart Month, you know, I got to do my plug. Please learn hands-only CPR. It can save lives.
Thank you. So I'm going to ask Mary now, having been the only HeartLink chair and doing this important work such a long time and sitting at the helm of our health linkage, what is the biggest lesson and takeaway that you've learned throughout your experiences as it relates to our members and their health?
So I go back to the whole issue of behavior change, because I've been grappling with that professionally and also on a volunteer basis for years. And the one thing that I learned, and I learned it from you, is that it takes time to change. It takes time to change. So give yourself the time that it takes to change. And if you miss a step, let's say you didn't go walking today, you can always do it tomorrow. You ate that fried chicken. Enjoy it. But know that, you got to do some salad and some other kinds of things, other foods rather later. And then, if I may, I just want to pick up on something that Jennifer Donnellan said, and that is self-care, care of yourself. And you said, okay, what have you seen over these years? One of the things that I've seen is that we as women are not taking care of ourselves. We really need to take care of ourselves first so we can take care of others, but taking care of ourselves first. So I see that a lot of our members of our organization and members of our community, especially women, we just don't take the time, as Jennifer said, to love ourselves.
Thank you for that. I think that Mary Clark was calling me out there, but that's all right. It does take time to change. Change is continuing to come. So let me go to our Madam Cardiologist, Dr. Epps Anderson. I could not leave this podcast without asking you to just kind of tell us, you know, we get this a lot, you know, symptomatology of heart attacks in women versus men. And sometimes you'll hear people say, well, do you have some pain in your arm? Do you have some this and that? And very often we as women say, well, no, I don't have that, so I'm not having a heart attack. Can you please, before we leave this podcast, just talk a little bit about the differences in symptomatology of heart attacks in men versus women?
Thank you. Thank you for asking that question, Madam President, because I think it's a great one. And it's a question that I get asked a lot. And the number one symptom for both men and women is chest pain. So that's regardless of sex. But we know that women often present with more atypical or subtle symptoms as well. And this is why sometimes it does get overlooked. What Jennifer was mentioning about her symptoms, you know, is this anxiety? Is this, could this be stress or a panic attack? And many women feel that way. And I often tell them, maybe it is, but that's a diagnosis of exclusion. We're going to start with making sure this isn't the heart before we assume that. And so symptoms of chest pain, as I mentioned, most common. I think the interesting thing is that a lot of women will say, no, I don't have chest pain. But then when you ask them, they do have discomfort in the chest. So they may not then necessarily recognize it as pain, but it's a sensation in their chest that they're having a hard time describing, but it's uncomfortable. Upper body pain as well, even back pain can be a symptom. Shortness of breath is actually a very common symptom in women as well. Almost half of women who present with heart attacks actually don't have chest pain at all as a descriptor, but they have shortness of breath. That's a symptom that can be vague because it can be so many things. And women write it off. Oh, I'm out of shape. I haven't been exercising. I've gained a little weight. And that is a symptom that often doesn't raise red flags either. And it should. Then other more subtle symptoms, lightheadedness, dizziness, nausea, vomiting. In women, there's even been what's described as a prodrome of symptoms, which are symptoms even for up to a month leading up to the heart attack. That could be sleep disturbances, anxiety. But overall, Jennifer mentioned just having this feeling of doom or this feeling that something isn't right. I think it's important to listen to yourself and listen to your body if you know that there's something not right, even if you don't know it's the heart. I think it's very important now that we all should know that heart disease is the number one killer of women, that you should think maybe this is the heart and make sure that you're getting to a doctor and making sure that you're persistent. So I have seen this before where women say, this is my third time coming to an ER or an urgent care, and this is the first time I've gotten an EKG for these symptoms. And the women were actually having a heart attack. And so I think it's important to be persistent too, if you feel like you're not being heard or listened to.
Thank you. Because not only was it the number one killer of women, Black women, when we started this 12 years ago, it's still the number one killer of Black women today. So Dr. Kelly Epps Anderson, what is the one thing you do to put your heart first?
I think, you know, Mary Clark said it well, Jennifer said it well as well, is I think self-care, so important. One of the things that the COVID-19 pandemic really showed me in taking care of patients is really the connection between the mind and the body, and that stress can impact blood pressure, impacts heart rate. It impacts us physically, but it also impacts our behaviors and what we do. And it can lead to things like overeating and can lead to physical inactivity. And so I think that making sure that we really do take care of ourselves, that we get good sleep, that we're well rested. That's one of the things I have worked on, is really trying to make sure that I get good sleep so that during the day, then I can make the good decisions about what I eat and that I can make time to exercise without feeling too drained or exhausted during the day.
That's a change that we have to talk about. I think Mary was talking about. Mary Clark, what is the one thing that you do? If I know you, and you may have told us, but if you did, tell us again to put your heart first.
So several things. One is I'm focusing more on sleep, trying to get at least 7 hours, 7 hours. I mean, I'm really laser focused on sleep. And also, eating is not a real big issue, but the physical activity, just staying with that and not letting anything in the world interfere with it. Moving more, just moving more. Those are sleeping and moving. That's where my mind is, because it's not hard for me to eat healthy. It really is. Change my palate.
Thank you. And Jennifer, what is the one thing that you do to put your heart health first?
I will say this, the sleeping thing has become a huge thing for me as well. But I sleep and I go to the doctors and I'm honest with my doctors. I know a lot of people who are not honest with their doctors, but I promise you, it's like confession for me. I walk in and I'm like, this is what's been going on. This is what I'm doing. Because my doctor can't help me if I'm not honest with them. So start talking real talk with your doctors and make those appointments.
Well, there you have it. We are at the heart of the matter, Black women and cardiovascular disease, for this particular podcast. What an insightful, inspiring, and important conversation. We as women and as a community as a whole have been made better by the perspectives of our renowned cardiologist, Dr. Kelly Epps Anderson, heart attack survivor and advocate, Jennifer Donnellan, and chair of both the Heart Links, National Heart Links, and Walk for Healthy Living Committees, Mary Clark. Thank you all for joining us for this episode of the Links Incorporated LinkedIn Learning Connected in Conversations podcast. For more information on the Links Incorporated, please visit linksinc.org. Thank you again for joining, and ladies, thank you for your insight.